taking any moves to, I can appreciate your working with the Barrow people to establish a museum up there, but what about these people that still go out, disturb the sites, take the artifacts? Can you do anything?
We cannot do a thing. This is a matter, in the first instance, of state law, and the second instance of local ordinance, but largely one of enforcement, not only in a legalistic sense through the Department of Public Safety, but also one of community interest and community social pressure. That people have been engaged in this activity, in the sense, time-honored, as it were, ever since the arrival of whites in that area. And it's terribly difficult just to walk in, and certainly as an outsider, it's impossible just to walk in, and say that this practice, which in times of hardship has been a very important source of income for a number of Barrow residents, to then suddenly come in and say, well, now we are interested, and you will stop this activity. This just cannot happen. And it is, on the one hand, a question of enforcement of the law on public land, but in terms of private land, that is entirely at the landowner's discretion. That the law in no way covers, controls the movement, disturbing, trade, selling, or whatever, of antiquities on his land. So that if somebody comes into that, into a private landowner's property, and has the permission of that private landowner, he can dig.
Some of these sites are designated. Some of these sites are designated archaeological sites that the common person can't touch them, or how is that to be handled?
There is a crazy quote in Barrow of public lands and private lands. There's a lot of federal land. There's some federal BIA trust land. There's a wide range of ownership. The city has established an historic preserve in one portion of the site, in which they apparently are intending to allow no development. And it is in this area where we've been excavating, in part, with their permission. The bluff edge itself runs along and cross-cuts land owned by the city, land owned by municipal utilities, land owned by private landowners, and so on. There are, I think, restrictions on what can be done in the historic preserve. That is, it's basically intended to be a preserve and to be protected. But there is continuing excavation by people, especially when the weather's good out in that area. And there is actually relatively little, it seems to me, being done in a formal fashion to stop it. As a matter of fact, I'm not even certain that people who own land privately there and have sites on them are very concerned themselves, or actively seeking to stop it, if only because they're concerned about erosion. That is, it doesn't seem to be a major level of concern for the present level of pot hunting or relic collecting activity that's going on there. It's going through a period of, I suppose, if one were really charitable, you could say benign neglect. But there isn't very much going on. There isn't a lot of concern. And it is the rate at which this is happening, you see, is hampered because most of the ground is frozen, and it's on the edge of the bluff where the sun gets to it and so forth, and where the sea facilitates erosion. You don't have to worry about the back dirt, just sort of behind you, it goes down the talus, so that a lot of this is occurring. So it actually is occurring at about the rate at which the land is eroding. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of digging except in that location. So people aren't running around, you know, creating big potholes all over the place and so on. It's not that kind of thing. In the summer, when it's warm, there may be, you may be able to walk up to the bluff edge and look up and down and see maybe 8 or 10 people at any one time doing it, directly proportional, I think, to the angle of the sun.
Can I ask you why you didn't, I'm from the newspaper, and so I would love to have photos of the site or something a little bit more specific than what we have here today. Is there any reason why you don't have something like that?
You might repeat the question.
Yeah, the question was asked basically why we have been so improvident in providing such a minimal amount of photographic material on our finds. There are two concerns there. The first is basically that this we are in a very preliminary state. The phenomena which precipitated this press conference, for example, is nothing archaeological, but deals mostly with the presence of Dr. Zimmerman and the preliminary results from the autopsy. Were we still in the field, we would not be discussing, I guess, at this point in time, the results of the archaeological expeditions, although I suppose we could, but we were simply not geared up for it. The second phenomenon is that we are extremely sensitive to the interests of the community in Barrow. We are, as you may gather, completely dependent upon their goodwill for the continuation of our activities and so forth, in which we place a very high priority, as you might gather. And one of the major concerns of people in Barrow, and one which we respect, is that they wish, they have entrusted us with the care of these specimens and these human individuals, and it is a trust which we bear with some caution. And we're extremely concerned that the finds not be sensationalized, that they be treated with respect and dignity. And we felt, quite frankly, that any photographs which included, at this point in time, the specimens themselves would be inappropriate. And therefore, we did not bring them. There are, now, we will, I'm sure, make photographs available to you later on, as soon as we can get them back to Binghamton, for example, or other places and process. We'd be glad to send you some.
I might like to add that it's Dr. Zimmerman speaking, that I'm very honored to have been allowed to examine these bodies, and must point out that these are individuals who are relatively recently deceased members of this community, and they deserve the privacy that they should be getting, and that's one of our major aims.
Dr. Zimmerman, were you surprised to find hardly any of the artists?
No. As you probably know, about 10 years ago, I came up here and examined a lady from St. Lawrence Island who had been frozen for 1,600 years. She was about 50 years old, and she too had arteriosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries. I've also found the same thing in Egyptian mummies, and it's been described in mummies from South America, so this is quite an ancient disorder.
You mentioned that the bodies will be taken back for burial. When will that be happening, and what will happen, and who will own the other artifacts that have been discovered?
I'll take that. This is Al Deacon. The plans are being made at the present time for reburial in Barrow in a what you might describe as a common grave for these bodies and for the skeletons of some individuals that were obtained last year. Last year, we dug a number of squares in which burials from the so-called Bernard period were found. They are several centuries old, and were much older than these particular finds this year. It has always been our intent that these bodies be returned to Barrow for reburial following scientific examination, a principle which we did establish last year, and which basically we're following this year as well. Once again, the removal was basically predicated on an understanding that we would treat them with reverence and dignity, that we would examine them and analyze them so that whatever information they contained would be retained for our use and for general knowledge, and that they would be returned to Barrow for a proper burial. And in Barrow, that is assumed to mean a Christian burial. And it is our understanding that the bodies will be returned approximately in the middle of September, that the bodies from last year will be returned at approximately the same time, and that all of these individuals may be put, probably not in the same grave, but in the same general location, in a formal cemetery in Barrow. The artifacts, as we mentioned before, following the general principle, that is the case, that the ownership of the artifacts belongs to the landowner. In general, that's true in most places in this country. And in this circumstance, the landowners from most of our excavations have been very understanding. They share a common interest and a common heritage, and have, in most cases, allowed the artifacts to be taken out for study, to be returned ultimately, and then the intention is, and most people have agreed, that they will be turned over to the Northfield Borough for their museum. However, until that is actually accomplished, ownership is retained by the landowner, okay, and we enjoy the privilege of their, again, of their trust, that these artifacts will be taken out for analysis and ultimately returned.
Because of the spectacular nature of this find, won't there be museums from all over the country that will be buying to get a piece of these artifacts?
The question was whether, given the spectacular nature of these particular artifacts, whether museums from across the country will be buying to obtain some. That raises a very interesting historical question. You know, anthropologists and archaeologists who have been going to the North Slope for the last century and a half have been principally responsible for establishing and initiating a trade in artifacts. Artifacts were most recently purchased in Barrow by anthropologists in 1967, for example. Right? And we have, I think, our historic feet are somewhat sullied by it. And it is the case that a number of institutions around the country have extensive collections from this area. The Smithsonian has some. American Museum of Natural History, for example, has some. And several other major universities in the East have collections. So that it is true that there is an interest in artifacts of this nature, and it is true that there are major collections outside. The entire collection from the last 2 years represents probably the largest collection of Eskimo artifacts obtained from one area, okay, at any one particular point in time and under one particular project. Excuse me. The scientific value and the historical value of these artifacts for exhibit purposes and so forth is quite large. And it is the case that if one were to attempt to break up this sort of a collection, the significance that comes from having it as a whole would, of course, be lost. And so it would be our hope that the collection could be retained. We think that its proper repository is the museum in Barrow. And at the present time, it's our intention to return them to the property owner or the North Slope Borough, assuming that they have a proper location for them and so on to keep them in the style to which they ought to become accustomed.
Thank you very much.
Judging from either the artifacts or the shape of the bodies or whatever, can we narrow down how many years ago this catastrophe happened?
Yes, we can. It's certainly pre-contact. That's 1826. Well, certainly, I would amend that to say certainly pre-whaling, in the 1850s, after the introduction of whaling into the North Slope, as you had the very rapid influx of Euro-American artifacts and acculturation. White contact is 1826. Reasonable chance that this preceded contact. This is also in accordance with the oral tradition of the people of Barrow. Looking at the bottom end of the date is we give a very rough figure of 250 years ago. The reason for that being that the founding of the village has not been established archaeologically. The reason for this is that the conventional radiometric dating methods are not applicable in this very, very recent period. You get a standard error which is so large that you can hardly use the date, or in many cases in this sort of very late context, you may even get a date into the future.
Yes,
radiocarbon dating, yes. Also, the chronology of these types of late prehistoric, proto-historic, or early historic Eskimo artifacts is not well known. We do have a fairly good chronology going back in time, but just at this very, very end of the prehistoric period, the chronology is just not that complete and not that fine. However, there is some ethnographic data that suggests a bottom line date of 250 years ago. The reason for that is that the founding of the Utqiagvik village is known as a historical event, is related in the oral history of these people. The exact date cannot be reconstructed, but looking at comparable contexts, the parameters of this sort of memory culture ranges between 200 and 250 years. after which time the oral history then becomes either lost, vague, or goes into a completely different time scale in the form of legend.
Speaking of the villages and other sites you found that voluntarily abandoned, are you seeing the culture being more nomadic then than it was now? I didn't know if Eskimos traditionally nomadic.
Well, nomadic, the term nomadic I certainly would not use, certainly not for Eskimos on the North Slope, because they had a very well-regulated and organized seasonal round. So they certainly moved from place to place through the course of their seasonal activities. But this is not nomadic movement. They go from place A to place B to place C to place D, and they know jolly well where they're going to go and why and what they're going to find there and how long they're going to stay. The reason that you have a number of abandoned villages, certainly in the late historic period, is a result of the contraction of the settlement in that area due to a combination of white contact and disease. Many of the communities were wiped out by infectious diseases, were no longer viable communities, and you had people contracting into the main centers such as Point Hope, Kotzebue, and Barrow. And this process was furthered by the presence of missionaries and then Bureau of Indian Affairs schools.
Shut it down, maybe ask Anchorage, we're about to shut it down. Do you have any other questions?
We have a photo here of a man in a parka bending over a pit. Could you explain what he's doing?
That's the picture of the landowner.
Can you describe the photograph a little bit?
What's that?
Okay. It looks like there's a pit and there's measuring tapes
from
the bottom of the pit, and the man is holding
measuring
tapes.
It
looks like he's holding a...
Okay, we got
it. The man is a young lady, for a start. This has to do with... the misidentification has to do with a normal beach attire in Barrow. She is making a measurement on an artifact down at the bottom of the pit, on just to the south of the floorboard, measuring it from two coordinates with a plumb bob.
Can we have a name?
Yes, Claudia Hempel. H-E-M-P-H-I-L-L.
What's the artifact that you're making?
Oh my God. it looks like an item of clothing.
For your general information, Ms. Hempel is a graduate student of the University of Oregon.
Is she working regularly on the project?
Regularly is a good way to describe it, yes.
Supposed to be irregular.
Actually, this was irregular. This was morning shift.
Irregularly. Anything else from Anchorage?
Okay, that's a smart answer.
I think it was Dr. Newell who said that radiocarbon dating would not be accurate for this time period because it was so recent. What do you call the method that was used to date these finds?
Guesstimation.
Well, nothing else, we'll shut it down and thank you all very, very much.
Thank you, Dr. Myers, for arranging this, and all of us here in Anchorage, this is Larry Smith signing off, and we really appreciate the effort that went into this.
It's a little difficult to tell yet, other than it looks like it's going to be particularly crowded. Approximately 3 weeks ago, our applications for new admissions were running about 42% of the same period last year. Now, we're not sure if this is because people know that space is tight here at UAF and so are applying earlier, or whether or not this pattern is going to continue throughout the entire application period. I should get a report in about another week or so, and if I don't see a flattening of that percentage by this time, we're going to presume that it's a fairly real figure that we have to deal with. We also have some major problems in student housing at the present time. We're well over 200 above capacity. We want to go into the fall semester a few days before the opening at about 112-113% capacity to accommodate the no-shows and a variety of people that leave early for one reason or another. So that's about the point that we want to be in late August. However, the capacity was reached this year 3 months ahead of last year, and so that's going to cause us some difficulties. So we are beginning to see some impact. All of this, of course, spreads into the instructional program, and how do we accommodate that? We are hopeful that our FY83 budget out of the legislature will recognize some of the enrollment growth. We're going to try to do whatever shifting of resources we can internal. And I suppose we'll have to look to some extent at a potential increase in the tuition. We won't know that until it goes through the board. But those are some of the things that we'll have to consider.
Why are people coming to UAM? Why are we getting these increases?
Oh, I suppose there are an assortment of reasons. One, I really do think that UAF in the last few years has come into its own and that this message is getting around across the state. Much of our new capacity, by the way, is in in-state enrollment, much of our new increase. So I think that word is spreading, that we have some very, very strong instructional programs here that people are interested in. Additionally, whenever economic conditions are relatively hard, we find that students gravitate to school more. I'm not sure that we're able to fully and accurately assess the impact of the student loan program, but an assortment of factors there. It's an attractive program to students who might not otherwise be able to go to school. There could be a further impact. The travel has been excluded as an item in the student loan program, and we're trying to assess whether or not that's even going to further increase our already existing increases. I'm sure it hasn't contributed to it thus far, because that's a relatively recent event, and the applications that I've spoken of have occurred much earlier. But we have a fine faculty and a good student body, and I think that word is finally beginning to spread. We're going to continue to try to accept students as long as we possibly can. One possible likelihood is that while we might accept them to the university, we might have to look at limiting the enrollment into certain programs that might be excessively overcrowded. The other thing, of course, we're probably going to have to soon be notifying students that, yes, we accept you to the university, but at the present time, you'll have to find your own housing. We're still working on trying to increase our housing capacity. We have already increased over last fall by 100 beds by moving some staff out of on-campus housing and by converting some other rooms from singles to doubles and that type of thing. So we're already 100 beds over where we were last fall, and we're already exceeding that capacity, and we're still looking for additional room.
Is the campus going to be centered in this range?
it appears to be that way at the present time. We have some flexibility in scheduling left, some early morning periods, some late afternoon periods, and so we might see a little bit more spread of the schedule throughout the day in order to fully utilize the facilities. Our large lecture hall capacity is severely limited. Certain laboratory areas are severely limited. And I expect that we're going to have some very tight conditions that we're going to have to live with, and they'll probably continue with us for a few years until we can alleviate some of the conditions with new facilities.
There will be a lot of impact. We were overcrowded last year. We're expecting even more students this year. Last year we had crowded sections. We did have some students who could not get particular sections they wanted, and we expect these problems to be even greater in fall.
What steps are being taken to alleviate it at this point?
Well, certainly we're trying to do the best we can to service lower division classes, and those upper division classes that are general university requirements or can be chosen as general university requirements. This means in some cases departments teach courses directed to their own major on an every other year schedule. Some sort of scheduling like this so that we can put as many people as possible into required classes, classes that, that people must take on a program.
Do you see any, where do you see the greatest impact, for incoming students or returning students?
I think it will, it's fairly well divided, really. I don't see it being particularly on new freshmen or indeed new transfer students. Freshmen may not be able to take English 111, for example, in their first semester, but they will be able to take it, and they will be able to take it early in their academic career where it does the most good. We do have students, however, who choose to take English 111 or Speech 111 or perhaps calculus class in their sophomore year. So some of these continuing students may also have trouble getting into a particular section they want. Now, we have done the best we can with the facilities available, the classrooms available, hiring lecturers, part-time people to supplement, add extra sections of these classes. I think that students will be able to get a correct program. They may not be able to take the mathematics course they want at the precise time that they want it. We may go to second or third choices there. They may not have exactly the right course, their first choice for a humanities requirement, but they will be able to take a humanities requirement, some course. So some students may have to go to second choices. I hope not too many, but we will do the very best we can to make sure that a majority of people get their first choices and everybody gets what they need to graduate.
Why is the College of Arts and Sciences so heavily impacted?
The College of Arts and Sciences teaches not all, but most of the general university requirements for graduation. Any student entering the university has to take certain communication classes, that is English or speech. They have to take mathematics or logic. They have to take a certain number of classes in the humanities and arts. They have to take a certain number of classes in the social sciences. And this is true whether they are an engineering major, a business management major, a physics major, a geology major, or an arts major. All of them have to do it. So it has been calculated that for every one student, full-time student, that enters the university during his academic career, almost half of his courses will be taken within the College of Arts and Sciences. So we see, as engineering grows, so do we. At the same time, our own majors are growing. English majors are growing. Music majors are growing. Physics majors are growing. So we see the impact not only of our own particular majors, but everybody else's majors, too.
I can see that. One last question. Have you noticed in the college, an increase in the more career-oriented fields, such as journalism and music, as adverse to history or political science?
Yes, students not only here in Alaska but everywhere in the 80s are very pragmatic these days. They are very career oriented. We see fewer students who are choosing a liberal arts major merely because this is something they want to learn and has no precise relationship to their career plans later. Most students now want to make sure that they are not only getting a broad education, but they are also getting specific training for a particular kind of career. This is, I think, a very great challenge for universities today to try to give people the training that they do indeed need to get a job after university, but at the same time to turn out educated and understanding people who do have a broad knowledge of art, of science, of the humanities, of human knowledge.
And I jumped around a little bit. Is there anything you would like to say back to that?
Thank you for your time.
Okay, what's the enrollment figure look like for this fall?
It looks extremely good. The figure of new students is running someplace around 1,800. Plus the returning students and without class standing students, enrollment has a good possibility of getting close to 5,000 students, if not a little over. But if housing is taken care of, staff is taken care of, sufficient classes are offered, there's no reason that Fairbanks campus shouldn't be enrolling on campus here, shouldn't be enrolling 5,000 or more students.
How does this compare to previous years?
Oh, this would be about a 30% jump, 20 to 30% jump from last year. Our average increase for the past 6 years has been approximately, on the average, around 10% a year. So, you know, in the past 6 years, we've already grown 60% of what we were in 6 years ago. So, this would kick us up another 30%, 20 to 30% within 1 year's time. And there's no reason we shouldn't achieve this if we have, again, the housing, the staff, and the classes to take care of them.
How are you getting these projections in layman's terms? How do you determine you're getting this increase?
Well, it's a complicated thing, but the present projections that I'm using, which I call short-term projections, are based upon the number of applications and then the rates of applications as they come in, and based upon previous year's experience, and I use several different approaches, the average of the past 10, 11 years, has it changed, has the rate of change, has the rate of applications changed in the past 2 years. So then we can project, and I usually use three measures, April, June, and August. So we can project based upon previous history and modify it a little bit if it looks like the rate has been modified a little bit, so that we can project June, again, August, number of applications that we will receive in August. Then from each of these, we can project an enrollment figure for the actual fall. Again, this is based upon what has happened in the past. Since these things change slightly from year to year, if we see a major change, then as we have in the last 2 years, where people have been applying early. And so even though the rate of application we expect to drop in the next 2 months, the experience of the last 2 years indicate that we will have close to 4,500 applications by the end of August. Now, of course, not everyone's going to show up. But based upon our experience of the last 2 years, a good proportion of them will show up. And again, based upon varying rates of enrollment versus the number of applications received at various times, it looks like a huge increase.
Are we doing a better job of retaining our students also?
Oh gosh, yes. Our retention rate in the past 3 or 4 years is running right in the 80s. In other words, of the ones who were here, and I'm talking from the spring to the following fall, and the ones who were here in the spring, and I'm talking primarily just degree-seeking students, not the occasional student who drops in and wants to take a course. I'm talking about degree-seeking students. Our rate is in the 80s. I usually run it without discounting the graduates, but when you take the number of graduates out that graduated each spring, you know, then we're retaining around 80-some-odd percent of our students.
And how does this compare to the national?
It's difficult because colleges differ in this, but they're running somewhat the same rate in the last few years. Previously, all in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, we were running around 70%. So we, in the last few years, with attention given to serving the students better, providing better programs, and wider choices for them, we've been able to increase our retention rate 10-11%.
I've jumped around a little bit.
Sure.
One thing I hadn't asked that I should have asked.
Well, would you like to know what I think the reason that we're getting such a big one? All right. In the last 10 years, with the advent of the Alaska Student Loan Program, as much as 71% of the recently graduating seniors have used this money to go out of state. In the past 2 years, out-of-state tuition, transportation costs, cost of living have gone up so much that even with the increase in the loan, students are having difficulty, or actually parents are having difficulty, paying for this out-of-state tuition. Our programs, when a person goes out-of-state at the undergraduate level, a good many of them are not going to prestigious schools. They're going to other state schools. Our programs here are equal to, in many cases, superior to those outside. And it was primarily the attraction of an outside school, that people were going out. So in the last couple of years, people have been looking at the cost benefit of attending college. And UAF has become a very attractive place to be. In this, with the recent change, there's been just a recently there's been a change in the student loan program, and no longer are they able to add the cost of travel in calculating the total cost of going to school. So this has put a big crimp. So you have about three things. You have more students going to school than, say, in the early 70s or late 60s. You have a wider range of people. For the past few years, our students have been older. They've been out of school 1 or 2 years, the majority of our freshman class. And so these people will continue to come. With the recently graduated seniors who have been going out, staying within state in large numbers, we're seeing this tremendous increase and tremendous pressure, not just on UAF, but on all of the Alaskan schools. So this is one of the major reasons that we're having such a big increase this year.
Thank you for your time.
Certainly.